Hi, this is Alan Chartok. I'm delighted to be in conversation today with Dr. Jamal Calloway. Dr. Calloway is from Oakland, California. He's a presidential postdoctoral fellow and visiting professor at the Center for Study of Race and Ethnicity in America at Brown University. This Saturday, February 10th, the Great Barrington Historical Society is sponsoring a lecture to be delivered by Dr. Calloway titled Believe in Life, the Enduring Influence of W.E.B. Du Bois, in celebration of the 150th anniversary of his birth. The event will be held at Searle's Castle on Main Street in Great Barrington from 3 to 5 p.m. and includes the talk and a tour of the castle. The event is free and open to the public, but seating is limited. Dr. Calloway received his Ph.D. in systematic theology at Union Theological Seminary in the city of New York, his Master's of Divinity degree from Yale University School, and his Bachelor's of Arts in Interdisciplinary Humanities from Tougaloo College in Jackson, Mississippi. Dr. Calloway writes about faith, resistance, and hope in the face of insurmountable evil. You can say that again. We'll talk with Dr. Jamal Calloway about all of this and much more. But first, welcome, Dr. Jamal Calloway.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, you're a young man. Am I allowed to ask how old you are?
I am 30 years old.
As I said, you're young and you've accomplished an incredible amount.
Oh, thank you.
So let me start by asking you what it is that made you who you are. In other words, your parents, did you experience adversity yourself? I mean, what is it that makes Jamal Calloway Jamal Calloway?
Oh, man, that's a great question, a big question. I would have to say a collective group of people. I come from a great family. I have great friends, a wonderful community. I would have to say my grandmother, one that's still living, one that has since passed away. I have three parents. My father remarried. I went to great schools that had wonderful teachers and wonderful faculty. I have great friends who I'm constant communication with. I have just a group of people that have made my life possible and flourish in a lot of ways that I'm just really grateful for.
So what did your folks do?
Well, my grandmother was just very, very dedicated. By the time she was my grandmother, and by the time I can remember, she was retired, and she really instilled a sense of moral rigor. She took me to church a lot. She talked to me about being kind, being polite to people. She taught me a lot about integrity. And, you know, sometimes I still feel like I fail to match up to the type of integrity she inculcated into me and those types of lessons. But I was just really grateful to have her as my grandmother. My father, he works in Sacramento, California. He delivers bread for a company. I'm the first of my family to attend college. So they really helped sort of form a community that was very supportive for me before going off to college.
How proud are they of you and your accomplishments, which are substantial?
I think they're very proud. I think they're very proud. I would have to say that I can do no wrong sometimes in their eyes, it seems. They're just really lovely people who, if I call and I need something or I just want to talk, I mean, everyone's there for me. They're really sort of hovered around me, I should say, to be whatever I need whenever I need it. I have great relationships with my father and my grandmother and my godparents. I have a great community. I think they're very, you know, proud of the things that I've done and accomplished. And I wouldn't have been able to do it without them. So it's not necessarily a mark on my tenacity and my dedication as much as it's a combination of having a great community and my own ambition.
I think you probably don't give yourself enough credit, but I'm very interested in the idea that you got a PhD in systematic theology. What's that?
Yes. Systematic theology is really anything dealing with organizing concepts or fluid concepts about God. What is the thinking about God? What are attributes of God? And anything dealing or circling around God talk. So that could also be faith in God or faith in a sort of cosmological universe that has intentions. It could be about God's actions, whether God acts in the world. Anything dealing with a sort of theory or theology of history that states that God is present or maybe God is absent. So any sort of topic that deals within that arena falls into the category of systematic theology.
So what was Union Theological like for you? How disparate was it? Were there different kinds of people there?
Well, Union Theological Seminary, it was once a Presbyterian seminary that had to follow the rules and sort of theologies of a certain type of doctrine and creed. But there was a New Testament theologian, Charles Augustus Briggs. Charles Augustus Briggs was a New Testament theologian. He was Presbyterian, and he sort of stepped away from thinking about the Bible literally. He saw it more as a text that spoke to morality, that had sort of mythological concerns. He sort of showed that the text had a sort of life of its own that can't necessarily be reduced to a literal interpretation. That didn't fare well with the Presbyterian Church. And so the seminary had to make a decision. Either we're going to side with Charles Augustus Briggs and become an independent seminary, or we're going to fire Charles Augustus Briggs and, you know, maintain our relationship with the Presbyterian Church and rules. The seminary decided to side with Briggs and become an independent seminary. And years later after that, maybe 120 years later or so, the seminary hires a theologian by the name of James Cone. And James Cone is the father of Black liberation theology. And that has started in sort of the 1970s. The text comes out in 1969, 1968, Black Theology, Black Power. And then a second text in 1970 entitled Black Theology of Liberation. And around the globe, there are liberation theologies emerging in the world. Gustavo Gutierrez, Latin American liberation theology. You have the Dalits in India with Dalit liberation theology. You have growing West African and South African liberation theologies. So the world is really trying to deal with theology and colonialism or theology and racism. You have feminist theology that's really growing. Then you have the emergence of womanist theology, which is theology from the Black woman's perspective. And so Union Theological Seminary becomes a sort of center in the U.S. for all these disparate liberation post-colonial voices. And so its identity becomes the center of liberation theology. I decided to pursue a PhD there because I'm also interested in race, justice, theology, God talk, freedom, faith, redemption, and those concepts that I think the school is really known for honing and training.
I'm so interested, Dr. Calloway, Jamal Calloway, in what you just said about colonialism. Now, I have no doubt that colonialism was used as an organizing principle along with religion, right? I mean, you know, they had at one point been one in the same, or at least very close. How does one get away from that as one develops, you know, your own intellectual persona?
Well, one understands that certain concepts and terms are fundamentally amoral. The morality of certain terms, for example, take religion, the morality or the integrity of the practices, of the ideas, of the insights are contingent upon its practitioners, on those who sort of possess and inhabit and function within the religion. And so you understand that there is no term that is inherently moral on its own, but is instead defined by those who adopt it. So when it comes to religion, if one comes from a background or one sort of trains oneself to think about the world in a particular way, religion automatically becomes the tool of that insight.
And is that difficult? I mean, you have to forge your own way.
Oh, no, I wouldn't say I have to forge my own way. There are countless people who've been before me, ancestors. Du Bois, for example.
Douglas.
Harriet Tubman, Sojourner Truth. I come from a tradition of Black people, Black religious people, not just Christian, but Black religious people who have taken their religious beliefs and combined it with their, you know, social, political, historical, ideological beliefs, and really sort of carved out a space for their own voices within these particular traditions.
So now you
I see myself as following in that tradition.
Gotcha. So now you get to Brown, where you teach, right?
Yes.
And how is that? It's in many ways a very progressive institution. Do you find open arms?
I would say so. I would say I find open arms. It's a very progressive institution, one of the most progressive institutions that I've ever been a part of. They pretty much are a progressive liberal arts Ivy League institution that allows its students to sort of stumble and creatively find their identities and take whatever classes they desire. So it really is a wonderful institution to sort of, I guess, edit one's imagination as they go. Cultivate one's imagination as they go, if you will. And I find it's a really open place. The problem with progressive institutions oftentimes is that instead of seeing religion as something amoral, they see religion as already inherently something and that something is contingent upon their experiences. And so oftentimes, religion, and particularly Christianity or even Islam, whatever the media or the dominant media portrayal or whatever TV says that it is what students sort of assume before really getting to study in it on its own. And so I find myself having to teach in ways that are more about unlearning in the very beginning. And so students have to unlearn what they thought about different religions, and in my case, specifically Christianity, that Christianity doesn't automatically mean a sort of right-wing or conservative values. And those things aren't bad on their own terms. I'm not saying to be right-wing or to be conservative is a bad thing. But oftentimes, there's this easy connection between the two because there has been a sort of dominant media portrayal of a particular religion.
So you get to Brown and you find a fairly liberal, although I'm sure there have been some conservative students too, who go to Brown, and you're faced with pre-existing prejudices.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
Very interesting. Okay, into all of this comes your very important understanding of W.E.B. Du Bois. What does he mean to you?
Oh, man, Du Bois means a whole lot to me. Ever since I was a kid, I was, I believe, 11 or 12 years old, and my birthday came around, and I had an aunt. It was a fictive kin. She wasn't necessarily my mother's sister, but my mother really saw her as a little sister. And she purchased two books for my birthday. One book was entitled Up From Slavery, written by Booker T. Washington, and the second text was The Souls of Black Folk by W.E.B. Du Bois. And inside of the book, they were both yellow books, thin. They were Dover editions, I believe. She said something to the effect of, you may not understand this now, but when you get older, you will reread these books. And I tried to read The Souls of Black Folk, but his language was so vivid. It was so flavorful that at 12 or 11 years old, I really couldn't grasp the meaning. Up From Slavery, it was much more of a narrative text, so it was a little easier to read. And both texts I sort of came back to when I got older. Now, my relationship with The Souls of Black Folk, I became a minister when I was 19 years old, I believe. And I decided that I wanted to read the Bible front to back. I wanted to know what the Bible says, wanted to sort of follow the story on my own. I was about 19 years old. And after I finished it, I think I spent a little over 2 months reading it. And when I finished it, I was like, okay, well, what do I do now? What do I read? Of course, rereading it. But I picked up The Souls of Black Folk, the same edition that my aunt had given me, maybe about 6 or 7 years prior to that. And I started reading it, and it just grasped me. It just sort of touched me. It was a phenomenal text of essays that were beautiful and poetic and brilliant and insightful. And it really sort of gave me an understanding of where I stood in the world racially. And ever since then, it's a text that I constantly return to. It's a text that I studied while in college and wrote my bachelor's degree senior paper on it and won the school award from Tougaloo College. He means a lot to me just as a human being. He basically gave me a sort of language. He gave me a language, and he gave me binoculars to sort of see far ahead. And he sort of gave me a time machine to see the past, sort of see history. He's just a phenomenal, wonderful intellectual that I constantly reread every couple of months. There's either an essay, an article, or biography. He is African-American studies. There is no such thing as African-American studies or black studies at large without Du Bois. I have been to where he was born in Great Barrington on Main Street. I've also visited his gravesite in Ghana, in Accra, Ghana. Went through his house and seen his robes and his books and his bed where he fell asleep in 1963 and didn't wake up, and also seen where he was buried outside of the home. I've sort of followed his life. He means a lot. Every single year in Great Barrington when I'm there, he has an essay in The Souls of Black Folk entitled Passing of the Firstborn. And his son died of a sickness when he was very young, and he was buried in Great Barrington Cemetery. And what I do every single year is I sit by that cemetery, I sit by his plot, the son and then Du Bois' first wife, and I read A Passing of the Firstborn out loud. It's not a very long essay, but it's long enough to sit there and sort of feel the words, feel the anguish, feel the poetry of Du Bois. And so even talking to you about all the different things that I do and have done related to Du Bois is currently exposing to me how much Du Bois means to me and how, you know, crucial he is to my life.
We're talking to Dr. Jamal Calloway, and he is visiting professor at the Center for Study in Race and Ethnicity in America at Brown University, and so much more. Okay, let me go back to some of the things you've been talking about. I'm astounded. You just told me something, which was that you became a minister at 19. How do you do that?
Yes. I felt what we call in our language a calling. I felt a sort of inward vocational pull to a life that I had never conceived. That's why I could see it as a calling, because in all my years growing up as a teenager, I had never, ever imagined that I would be a minister or a preacher. Those were sort of embarrassing terms, this moral figure standing in front of you on Sunday speaking on behalf of God. It's not a vocation or a career that I ever looked at and said, I want to do that. But around 18, 19 years old, I became a Christian. I sort of converted. I grew up in a Christian household, but it became my personal religion, maybe 17, 18 years old. And then around 19, I felt like it wasn't enough. And I sort of wanted to dedicate my entire life to being in some sort of communion or relationship with God, or who I thought God was. And at 19, I decided I wanted to be a minister. I was licensed at Macedonia Baptist Church in Sacramento, California. And being a minister inspired me to want to go to college. And so I became a minister before I went to Tougaloo College. And I wanted to sort of have a firm grasp of the Bible and the religious world. And then I also wanted to have a grasp of the world that I inhabited, the world that I lived in. And so that's the combination of the Bible and Du Bois, which is also ironically the two books that Langston Hughes said that he got to know when he was younger, that when he was young, he knew about the Bible and he knew about the words of W.E.B. Du Bois. And currently, I'm the minister of the Church of Christ in Mount Washington, Massachusetts. It's the mountain that sits on top of South Egremont. And our first Sunday is July 1st in the summer, and it lasts for 10 weeks. And I just love being the minister there. And if you're in town, come visit us.
So let me ask you this, Jamal, if I could call you that. Yeah. I'm sure everybody who's listening to this wants to know about God. You believe in God, right?
Yes.
And in what form? In other words, is it that you believe in Jesus Christ? Is it that you believe in something more ethereal? What is it? Can you explain to us what God means to you?
That is a fabulous question. And as a theologian, I don't get that question often, ironically. But for me, as a theologian and as a believer in God, I believe that it's hard to point to statements that are static about God. And so my learning about God, my writing and talking and thinking about God are constantly dynamic. And so the way I answer this question right now, I may not answer it the same way 2 years from now. I may not answer it the same way from 2 years in 5 years. So right now, I believe that God exists. I believe that God has particular desires for how the world should function socially as well as environmentally. I believe that God suggests, that God pursues, that God guides, and that God directs. I do not believe that God enforces necessarily. I do not necessarily believe that God intervenes with power and sovereignty and dominance. So God is described as this sort of cosmic parental figure who in many ways is kind of sort of a bully at times, kind of sort of security. And sometimes she is kind of depicted as a genie, like a wish fulfiller. I don't necessarily subscribe to those things. I necessarily believe that God is this essence that has something that can only be described in anthropomorphic terms, such as personality, and that personality desires for right relations, that essence desires sort of a profound moral love and genuine kindness and warmth and care. And that is care for the planet, and that is care for animals, and that is care for human beings amongst each other.
So the image that so many people have of Christianity is Jesus Christ on a cross.
Yes.
A man, you just said, or she, on a cross. How defining is that image to you?
That image is central to me for a lot of different reasons. The first reason that it is central to me is that it sort of shows the failure of human conduct. That for those who sort of preach or declare or try to behave properly or with integrity or with genuine love and warmth, oftentimes fail because the forces of this world are too determined by greed and selfishness and avarice and things that can be categorized as evil. And so the crucifixion, and also remember historically, Jesus of Nazareth was not the only one who was crucified, that he was a part of a collective of human beings who had offended the Roman Empire, and that was their lot, to die of crucifixion. He wasn't the first nor the last. And sort of that imagery, that sort of historical moment, shows to Christians and to the world that when you try to do right, to put it much simply, that sometimes that the world is actually just too powerful, and sometimes doing right requires a sacrifice. Not necessarily requires a sacrifice. Let me say that differently. One's life can become a sacrifice in the moment of trying to do right or in moments of trying to do good.
There are three different roads I can go down here, and I don't know which one to go on.
But let me, all three.
Okay, so let me ask about religious bigots. You know, this is a world filled with people who, in the name of Christianity or Muslimism or Judaism at times, say, okay, you're not me, and therefore, you know, I'm justified in the name of God of destroying you or murdering your children or blowing up a church, and because I am a religious person. What do you make of that?
They have religion wrong. In fact, they have the world wrong. And religion becomes a tool to justify their wrongs. Oftentimes, religion is really just the weapon used for someone else's idea. If it's not religion, it will be something else. And if you try to show them within the religion that is improper, they'll just find another thing. And so oftentimes, religion is blamed for one's sort of violent ideology, one's desire to create separation and division and factions that sort of mean one's own superiority over the next person. And anything can be used. History can be used. Religion can be used. Philosophy can be used. Anything can be twisted or even read properly. It doesn't mean that, you know, the Bible or other texts are completely moral on their own terms. Sometimes there are things that one should not do in the Bible. I'm not really interested in the divide between should the Bible be read poetically, metaphorically, or should it be read literally. There are parts of the Bible that should be read literally, and there are parts of the Bible that should be read poetically. And the texts that sort of give moral commands about not murder, not killing, not stealing, not causing harm, those things I take very literally.
So let me ask you this. Mario Cuomo once said to me, you know, Shattuck, do you believe in hell? And I said, yes, sir, I do. And he said, where is it? I said, right here. And he said, you would make a good Christian. I never quite understood that, being Jewish, but I'm wondering what you make of that.
I don't necessarily know what he means by that, other than, well, maybe he sees that the world is something to be rejected and that heaven and peace and prosperity are with God in heaven. There's also the sort of existentialist Jean-Paul Sartre, that hell is other people, right? That we see in one of his most famous plays. Me, I don't believe that we have the knowledge to truly depict or understand or portray what a heaven and hell can be. Now, that is not to say that there isn't an afterlife or a heaven or a hell. I don't believe that we have the tools within our own epistemologies. I don't believe we have the tools within our own imaginations to say that this is hell is fire and brimstone and there's a land where you will constantly perish for eternity, or that heaven is this land of milk and honey and this paradise where the soul exists. I believe there can be, or there's a possibility, of course, of an afterlife, but I don't believe that humans possess that ability in their own thinking or imagination.
I just want to point out to everybody that we're talking with Dr. Jamal Calloway, postdoctoral fellow and visiting professor at the Center for Study of Race and Ethnicity in America at Brown University. Dr. Calloway will be talking about the enduring influence of W.E.B. Du Bois this Saturday from 3 to 5 p.m. at Searles Castle in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. Okay, so the second road I want to go down here is a single word in the form of a question, which I recently put to Harry Belafonte when we did an interview. And I said, I have a question for you. And I said, Trump? Question mark?
I don't really have much to say. I do not think that he is a positive figure. I do not believe he should be a servant leader. I believe that he is a multi-billionaire who doesn't understand that the world does not belong under his thumb. He is not a figure that I support. He's becoming a figure that I don't even listen to. It's like I have to because he's constantly on news and he's constantly coming across the screens of, you know, social media and my phone. But I do not agree with a lot of the things that he says and his ideas. And I don't agree with his posture, his demeanor. One can disagree with policies and ideas, but the way that he behaves within the disagreement or even after the disagreements for me shows that someone sees their role as the president of the United States as more of a dictator, as more of an emperor or an overlord. And so I don't really have a whole lot of positive things to say about Donald Trump.
But is going back to a few seconds ago, isn't he proof of a living hell? I mean, let me expand on that for a moment and say, you know, upward of a third of this country believe in the very things that are so antithetical to you.
Yes, he is proof that injustice reigns supreme, that it is actually a lot easier to be someone who cares about their own needs and their own desires. It's not so much that he's proof that this world is hell, because I do believe that there have been communities and there are communities that have found moments of heaven, that found moments of beauty, that cultivate moments of living in spite of, you know, the domination of figures like Trump. Trump is who he is, but he's also representative of what it means to need to live off of the inferiority of other people. And for those people who either pay him little mind or who go on about their lives and creating lives outside of him, outside of his rhetoric, outside of the domination of the U.S., he's also proof that hell, that power and domination don't have the last or the final say.
So now, do me a favor. Marry my questions about Trump to the admiration that you have for Du Bois. Now, Du Bois isn't here, but what would he say about a Trump?
Oh, I think what Du Bois would say about a Trump is what he would actually say about the United States of America out at large, that it is a selfish, greedy, nationalist nation that exists at the expense of other less powerful countries. And those less powerful countries are countries where people are racialized. That'd be black and brown Asian countries. Du Bois died in Ghana, not dying in Great Barrington, not having passed away on U.S. soil. He was sort of disregarded. He was dismissed by the U.S., black and white. And for him, the U.S. was close to unredeemable. And so what he would say about Donald Trump is that Donald Trump is a good or a perfect representation of the ideals of the United States of America.
Yeah, but what about the Bobby Kennedys and the, you know, Jack Kennedys, the people who offer the antithetical approach to a Trump?
I don't know if Du Bois would say that Bobby Kennedy is antithetical to Trump. I think he would say that Bobby Kennedy is not as bad as a Trump. There are levels and degrees. For Du Bois died a Pan-Africanist, that desired solidarity across all of these less powerful countries. From Puerto Rico to Haiti, there should be a partnership that would help with their resources and help with their positions within global political conversations. So for Du Bois, yes, there are figures who are not as bad, so to speak, as Donald Trump. But being not as bad is not a case of being rewarded.
Well,
that until the United States decides on its own terms to become less powerful, to stop dominating. I think for Trump, Trump's desire to make America great again means to make America superior again in its identity and in its political ordeals when it comes to international policies. And for Du Bois, that's evil. That's evil to him. That there are countries that should not exist at the expense. There are countries that should not be bullied by the United States of America. And so for Du Bois, I would see him seeing or saying that Donald Trump is actually a president that's in perfect line with presidents that have preceded him.
Okay, so let's go a little further. You know, Du Bois was a communist, right?
Yes.
In the best sense of the word, I may add, you know, he believed, yes, as my friend Pete Seeger would always say, you know, he believed in more equality. So,
yes.
So my question to you would be, he also, of course, had political allegiances, including in Ghana, to mm-hmm. people who might be considered dictators.
Yes. Yes.
How do we reconcile that?
Well, it's very hard to reconcile that. Du Bois wasn't the perfect moral figure himself. It's hard to reconcile trying to create a more just and more humane world with human beings. Du Bois, his church in Great Barrington growing up, one of them was the Congregationalist Church. And at the time, his pastor was Reverend Scudder, I believe. I don't know if it's Scooter or Scudder. And Scudder was a devout Calvinist. And to be a devout Calvinist means you have a very low theological anthropology, that human beings are sinful, that they are greedy, and that they need Jesus Christ for salvation. They need Christ as a figure to sort of call them and pull them out of their human avarice. And so it's hard to sort of, you know, try to create a better just world when human beings are so prone, or as Immanuel Kant would say, have this propensity to evil, to selfishness and greed. And so in trying to create a better world, you find yourself with people who also fail at sustaining or keeping or even achieving the ideals that they pronounce publicly.
The Calvinists were predestinationists, weren't they?
Yes, yes. There were Calvinist predestination, yes.
So, you know, if we are predestined, how much choice do we really have in what we can do with our lives? I mean, you say he went to the church. That's the message he was getting.
Yes. Well, he wasn't a Calvinist.
Yeah, he just listened to them. Yeah.
Yes, he was his pastor, and I think Du Bois is actually much more influenced by Judge Dewey, if we're talking about Great Barrington again. Judge Dewey had a lot of issues with Reverend Scudder's theology, and Judge Dewey, a very influential political figure in Great Barrington at that time, was much more into the growing liberalism.
I'm going to tell you something that's going to astound you. Guess whose
okay.
house we're living in? The Shartocks are living in. Judge Dewey, of all people.
Oh, that's wow.
Well, he actually never lived in it. He built it for his daughters and his wife, and they moved in. He didn't make it that far, but as you remember, Judge Dewey was an important figure because he was the
yes.
presiding judge in the Lizzie Borden trial. So,
yes, yes.
And we have a big picture of Judge Dewey as you come into our house, which I hope you'll
oh,
see.
Wow. Fascinating.
But in any case, I couldn't resist, and I know it diverted you from where you were going. So this is fascinating. We're learning something about Judge Dewey we didn't know.
Yes, yes.
And his theological position, Dewey's position, was what?
He was much more influenced by theological liberalism. He did not like or agree with the Articles of Faith that Reverend Scudder was so adamantly trying to preach. Reverend Scudder came from a very evangelical American time, spearheaded by Jonathan Edwards, who I believe lived in Stockbridge. Stockbridge, funny thing about Stockbridge, Massachusetts, is that two famous American theologians lived and died in Stockbridge, and that one being Edwards and the other being Reinhold Niebuhr, who died, I believe, in 1972. But as far as Judge Dewey, yes, he was very much influenced and in trying to keep up with the theological liberalism. And so for Du Bois sided with Judge Dewey, even though he loved the congregational building. It was brand new when Du Bois was about 15 or 16 years old. And so for him, predestination and theological Calvinism and those sorts of doctrines were not appealing to him by any means whatsoever.
So tell me about how influential, because I live in Great Barrington. Du Bois is a huge figure, of course, now. It wasn't always that way when some of the right-wingers fought even mentioning his name because he was a communist. Yeah. But tell me how important the town of Great Barrington, after all, you're going to be talking at Searle's Castle, the town of Great Barrington was to Du Bois.
It was very important. He grew up in a very small community. There was a very small black population. He grew up with his mother's family. His father's name was Alfred, and his mother was Mary. And they worked for the Beckwith family. They did a lot of odd jobs to maintain. And Du Bois, he sort of pivots a lot when writing about his understanding of his racial identity. Sometimes he states that he was in a small schoolhouse and the kids were giving each other cards, and that there was a young white girl who pivoted and decided to not give him a card. And that's the moment he realized that he was racially different from all of his peers. Sometimes he states that it was actually while traveling to see his grandfather, his paternal grandfather, in New Bedford, Massachusetts, I believe, that he realized his racial identity while traveling and seeing all these different people. Great Barrington is important, mostly because, not just so much as far as his growing up and his learning, he had a high school principal named Frank Hosmer, I believe. And Frank Hosmer really cultivated Du Bois' mind as a young teenager. Du Bois never really thought about college education, you know, in the early or later half of the 19th century wasn't a big thing. But Frank Hosmer asked him if he wanted to take college curriculum classes. And those classes required books that were a little too expensive for Du Bois' family. And Frank Hosmer provided a way for those books to be funded. And so Du Bois took Latin, he took Greek, he took British history. Frank Hosmer, his principal, really sort of dedicated a lot of time and energy into cultivating a very young, curious Du Bois. Great Barrington is also important because he wrote for a lot of different newspapers at the time. He would go to the town hall, he would read the newspapers, he would be very much involved in the local politics of the community. He would write about whatever new elections was going on. I believe there was an election for a night watchman in town, and there was a white Democrat and a black Republican. And the town,
it wasn't that far off from the Civil War when you think about it.
No, it wasn't that far off at all. Was not that far off. He was born in 1868.
Wow.
And so he was at the tail end of the Civil War. And at 12, 13 years old, he becomes really involved in what's going on in the community. And after the white Democrat wins, he writes this article in the Berkshire newspaper, and he basically states that it was because of race that the black Republican did not win. And that's also a moment that he says he really learned about, you know, racial subjugation and racial injustice in the community.
We're talking to Dr. Jamal Calloway, postdoctoral fellow and visiting professor at the Center for Study of Race and Ethnicity in America at Brown University. Dr. Calloway will be talking about the enduring influence of W.E.B. Du Bois this Saturday from 3 to 5 at the Searle's Castle in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. Okay, Jamal, this is terrific. Yeah. So now let's go to the NAACP.
Okay.
Tell us about that. You know, he was raised in Great Barrington. He's a reporter there. He learned something about racial identity. But it's a fairly benign place compared to some other racist places in the United States, right?
Yes, yes.
But somehow he gets to found the NAACP.
Yes, yes, yes. I believe NAACP was founded February 12th, 1909. Mary Ovington was also a part of the Great Barrington community. W.E. Du Bois and, I believe, a philosopher by the name of John Dewey, who was a professor at Harvard. All of these figures, a lot more other figures, got together to found what became the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. And it was a multiracial group that really decided that it was time to help out post-Reconstruction. Du Bois is a powerful member, a powerful voice. He also founded a magazine entitled The Crisis Magazine, where Jesse Fawcett is also a really big influence and editor, a very intellectual, just astonishing black woman in the early 20th century. What really gave him the impetus to be a part of the NAACP is really his time in Great Barrington, I would have to say. First, it would be his time in Great Barrington, and secondly, I would have to say it was his time in Fisk, and those two are connected. Great Barrington, after becoming a big writer, and he also wrote in 1884 for the Springfield Republic, and I think that was one of the biggest newspapers in Western Massachusetts.
Still is. Republican.
Still is,
yeah.
Yes. Yes, and he would write a lot about race and injustice as a young teenager. Unfortunately, Mary Sylvana, Du Bois's mother, passed away before Du Bois went to college. The community had really sort of taken a liking to Du Bois. Like I said, Frank Hosmer really sort of invested a lot into him, which is really sort of not really heard or talked about, you know, this very, you know, staunch white intellectual really giving into and pouring into a young black boy. The town wanted him to go to Williams College, but because of Frank Hosmer, Du Bois had his eyes set on Harvard. He wanted to go to Harvard. He wanted to be a student of Harvard. But Harvard at the time, they did not see Great Barrington High School or his record coming from Great Barrington High School as good enough. And so the town, Reverend Scudder, and the four churches, the Episcopal Church, the Congregationalist Church, the AME Church, and one other church that escapes me at the moment, decided to give $25 a year for Du Bois' education at Fisk University in Nashville, Tennessee. Now, the American Missionary Association was an association that actually started in Albany, New York, and it was a bunch of abolitionists that wanted to sort of help free black slaves and to help sort of create a better life. And what they did was they founded 11 colleges throughout the South, one being Fisk University and the other being my alma mater, Tougaloo College in Jackson, Mississippi. And so the town, religious intellectuals and political officials got together to really help Du Bois get a college education and sent him to Nashville, Tennessee, where he became a student at a historically black college university, that being Fisk University. And there, really seeing, you know, the effects of slavery firsthand, meeting the community and meeting people and trying to be, you know, a teacher in Nashville, Tennessee, I think that, you know, that combined with Great Barrington really helped propel him to be who he became as a writer and intellectual.
So had he gone to Harvard, we never probably would never have seen the maturation of the guy, right?
There is a possibility. I mean, he is the first African-American to get a PhD from Harvard. So he did go to Harvard
eventually,
after spending most of his doctoral studies at the University of Berlin. He went to Harvard at a phenomenal time. I mean, he had John Dewey, he had William James, he had George Santayana, he had some really strong American philosophers who were really trying to sort of create an intellectual independence from British intellectualism. And so you have the really one of the first crops of like some really American thinkers who also most of them have ties to Western Massachusetts. And so he went at a phenomenal time, then went to University of Berlin and met one of the most important sociologists in history, that being Max Weber. And he studied will become sociology and economics with Weber, and finishes a dissertation on the slave trade, and becomes just this dynamic figure. Du Bois is significant because he really becomes famous, or one of the most, he becomes famous for his writing. Du Bois wasn't necessarily an orator. Frederick Douglass gave speeches. He was famous because of his slave narrative and because of his abolitionist travelings. Mm. But Du Bois becomes famous primarily because of his writings.
So was he, Jamal, was he accepted into a higher political society? You mentioned Frederick Douglass. We know he gets invited to the White House. Is this something that could happen to Du Bois?
That's a good question. I don't necessarily know.
I mean, intellectually, he was superb. We know that. We're talking about Harvard and everything else. But I guess there was not the same political cash for a president to invite him as it would be. Or maybe he was too far left already. Who knows?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think he had the political cachet at the time of his writings, especially in the really early 20th century, the turn of the century. It's also at the time of really trying to take back a lot of the Reconstructionist interventions. And so you sort of have, this is also the rise of the Ku Klux Klan.
Sure.
You know, you have the lynching era really emerging and really beginning within U.S. society. And so you have the U.S. sort of taking back the progress, you know, progress, quote unquote, it has made for freed slaves, for this freed, I use very lightly, I like to say fired slaves. You sort of have the moments of the U.S. really sort of taking back any advances that it has made to help out or to make amends for the transatlantic slave trade and chattel slavery. And so Du Bois emerges at a time when it's actually very dangerous to be public. It is very, very dangerous to be a public black figure, especially maneuvering around the South.
Okay, we only got about 7 minutes left, so I want to hoard my incredibly important time with you. So Du Bois eventually goes to Ghana, as you point out, and he's disgusted. He's just disgusted. He thinks the United States is never going to get any better, basically.
Yes.
And that's what turns out to be true, right, in terms of race?
Yes.
So the Du Bois legacy is things were really bad. They're going to stay really bad. You've pointed out about the lynching, the KKK, and yet you have a president who goes on the television as we speak last night and says, oh, we made a little bit of progress because the society, the economics are doing better. Black people are doing a little bit better economically and taking great credit for that. What do you make of that?
You know, for Du Bois, the U.S. Was borderline hopeless, but the world at large isn't. And so one of Du Bois' last quotes, I don't remember the exact speech or piece of writing he did, but he writes, "Believe in life. Human beings will live and progress to greater, broader, and fuller life." And that's where the title of my talk comes from. Du Bois died not having a lot of faith in the U.S. as a country, but he believed that there are human beings outside of the U.S. and within the U.S. that had enough power, had enough influence, had enough moral strength and fiber to really deal with the problems of being a human being in the world. And so for him, one ought not give up hope, but one ought to be realistic about the evil and the domination that one is facing. And so for Du Bois, and by that time, he's in his 90s. You know, he's old, and he's just really working on the Africana Encyclopedia, because his mission in life was basically to show that black human beings across the world, Haiti, West Africa, the Caribbean, you know, the U.S., South America, Central America, are human beings. They are human beings that belong in the world and should be respected as such. They have the right to be intellectuals. They have the right to be criminals, human beings. We are not mythological figures that have to sort of become morally righteous in order to be respected, that we deserve a chance at life just like everybody else. And that was Du Bois' mission across the board, was to show that black people are fundamentally, intrinsically, and inherently human beings. And he believed that that was possible, and that was true.
So we only have a few minutes left, but I wanted to ask you this. You come to us by way of a religious orientation. Du Bois was a sociologist, as you say, Max Weber and Harvard and all. The two of those come together how?
Well, for me, as a theologian, I believe that human beings are inherently religious. We are inherently religious because we come up with rituals, we come up with performances, we come up with ideas. They do not need to be tied to a concept of a higher God, but they are tied to the way that we relate to one another. And so religion and sociology are tied together because they both tell a story of what it means to exist in time and space. How do we form each other socially? And where does religion and culture come into play? And there is no religion and culture without the collective social habits of groups.
And Du Bois believed in God?
Not necessarily. Du Bois was religiously ambiguous. For him, it wasn't an answer of yes or no. It was, if there be a God, help us. That's Du Bois.
We've been talking with Dr. Jamal Calloway, postdoctoral fellow and visiting professor at the Center for the Study of Race and Ethnicity in America at Brown University. Dr. Calloway will be talking about the enduring influence of W.E.B. Du Bois this Saturday from 3 to 5 p.m. at Searles Castle in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. The event is free and open to the public. Dr. Calloway, this has been such a pleasure. Thank you so much. It's been great getting to know you, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on WAMC's In Conversation with Alan series or to order a physical copy, call 1-800-323-9262 or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or on the Google Play Store.